It's 19 hours 30 UTC on Monday, December 4th, and this is Zimbabwe Today.
Piers Pigou with the Crisis Group says it's naive to think that because Robert Mugabe is no longer president of Zimbabwe, that human rights violations by the state and its proxies will stop.
That was Darren Tyler reporting from Johannesburg. We'll have that story and more coming up.
Good evening, I'm Mike Hove.
And I'm Chidonjere on VOA's Zimbabwe Today.
Zimbabwe's new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, has sworn in his cabinet. He immediately called for unity as his government attends to the broken economy. Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA News from Harare.
Mnangagwa, President of the Republic of Zimbabwe.
Members of Zimbabwe's cabinet took the oath of office Monday to work under the new President Emmerson Mnangagwa. It is the first time in Zimbabwe's 37-year history the oath is not being led by Robert Mugabe. The 75-year-old Mnangagwa answered some questions following the ceremony.
A new cabinet, just to finish the term of the former president, which is a period of between 6 to 7 months. It has been hectic, but I believe that with my team, we will stand to the challenge. That I want them united, we must grow our economy.
Mnangagwa took power last month in a military-led coup after the 93-year-old Mugabe fired him as vice president. The new president has not indicated if he will seek a fresh term in elections expected by middle of next year. A few meters from the State House, street vendor Vengai Muawa commented about the new cabinet. He says he hopes the government addresses the problem of cash shortages at banks instead of relying on plastic money, and he said it must create jobs. He says street vendors want to be chased by employers so that we get off the streets. Next to him is another street vendor, Silas Mawera. He says the composition of the new cabinet is okay, and Zimbabweans are expecting it to quickly address the economy so vendors do not have to remain in the streets. Besides attending to the economy, Zimbabwe's new president must unite his own ZANU-PF party, which was divided for years over who should succeed Mugabe. Many party members begged Mnangagwa, but others supported Mugabe's wife, Grace. The Mugabes have been granted immunity from prosecution and remain in Zimbabwe, living as private citizens. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
President Mnangagwa's cabinet is not without controversy. Many Zimbabweans expressed dismay that its members included many holdovers from President Mugabe's government. In addition, there were concerns about the presence of military officers in key posts. Over the weekend, Mnangagwa replaced two of his nominees, saying the adjustments were to make sure the cabinet complies with the Constitution. Some in the country suggest it is best to give the new team a chance, as they have expressed experience to start working immediately on resolving the country's problems.
Joining us in Studio 22 today to discuss the cabinet is Ndunga Milingomo from the Zimbabwe VOA service. Welcome, Ndunga.
Thanks, Big Mike.
So let's fire off, buddy. You know, we have a minimum amount of youths and a minimum amount of women in this cabinet. What are people saying about this?
Well, people are really not satisfied about the composition of this cabinet. The youth and women, they are really, you know, mad about it. We only have three women in this cabinet out of 22 ministers. There's only three women, and there's no, youth. The minister representing youth, that's Stembe Sonyoni, she's in her late 60s or early 70s.
Yes.
So that's really a cause for concern for many young people who feel that their issues will not be well articulated at the government level. And that's the policy, making level.
Now, we have a large amount of cabinet members that are coming from the Mugabe administration that are in the Mnangagwa administration. How is the international community bound to react to something like this?
Well, I don't think they expected anything better, really, because you know, the moment Mr. Mnangagwa or ZANU-PF made it clear that there wasn't going to be any national government, government, everyone was clear that all the ministers were going to come from ZANU-PF. So I'm sure the international community is well aware of that, and they have indicated that they are willing to work with the government so long as it addresses the issues that have been really problematic for the previous government. Mm-hmm. And those are issues to do with human rights, you know, electoral reforms and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Now, we still have, we have a lot of people from the army that are now part of the cabinet. And the army itself is, I believe, is still out there in the streets of Harare, Bulawayo, several different cities.
Mm-hmm.
Does this mean that Zimbabwe is now a military state?
That's apparently what some people are saying. That's what, you know, analysts are saying, because, look, we are not in a war time. And the military came, they removed the Mugabe government, they achieved their goal. Now we have a new government that, you know, they installed in courts. And people really feel it's time for the military to go back to the barracks where they belong. But the government has made it clear that they will be, you know, on the streets for some time. So many people are really, you know, concerned about that. And they're actually calling it a military state. This is how the militarization of a country starts.
A lot of people on social media are a little concerned about how the president reshuffled last minute. Are you hearing anything about this?
People are complaining, yes. Some are saying the president doesn't know what he's doing, because his initial cabinet, you know, went against the constitution, because instead of five non-constituency members that he's permitted to appoint by the law, by the constitution, he went on to appoint 10. But, you know, he has since tried to address that, but I don't think he has managed to do it, because I think there is still more ministers that, you know, he has to deal with. But again, coming to the composition, you look at these strategic ministries, the Minister of Finance.
Thank you so much for coming. I'm so sorry to cut you off. I know you keep going.
It's okay. Thank you.
An expert in transitional justice says the new administration in Zimbabwe must acknowledge the ruling ZANU-PF party's role in human rights violation if it's to be credible domestically and internationally. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
Piers Pigou with the Crisis Group says it's naive to think that because Robert Mugabe is no longer president of Zimbabwe, that human rights violations by the state and its proxies will stop.
Zimbabwe has a long history of torture and abuse, and many, many tens of thousands of people have been at the receiving end of violence. And this is why fear and violence and intimidation have been critical currencies, and to a large extent will remain so in Zimbabwe unless there is a proper acknowledgement and a proper way of engaging that.
Pigou, the Crisis Group's senior consultant for Southern Africa, has worked for two truth commissions. He also helped establish the Zimbabwe Torture Victims Project, assisting them with their medical, psychosocial, and legal needs. He has investigated atrocities like disappearances for the Truth Commissions of South Africa and East Timor. He says Zimbabwe's past contains the same issues that could warrant a similar inquiry into the past. But at this stage, Pigou is doubtful this will happen because, unlike in South Africa and East Timor, the same party still governs Zimbabwe. Its new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, is alleged to have had a role in past abuses.
It seems unlikely, given the primary perpetrating role of the ruling party, and it is alleged of its new chief executive, that these issues are going to receive a thorough airing in the short to medium term future. This is a huge concern going forward, and I think again presents an additional challenge in terms of any meaningful efforts to break with the past. It requires an acknowledgement and an ownership of violations, which it seems highly unlikely that ZANU-PF is going to engage with.
So far, Mnangagwa has denied any responsibility for the so-called Kukurahundi killings of Mugabe's perceived opponents in Matabeleland in the early 1980s, even though he was security minister at the time. And he has been silent on 2005's Operation Murambatsvina to clear city slums, which are strongholds of opposition groups, and on other crackdowns.
It was interesting in his inaugural speech that he held out an olive branch to white farmers, yet said absolutely nothing about the victims of Kukurahundi, the victims of Murambatsvina, which he was part of that government.
Pigou says Mnangagwa is likely to pedal softly around accountability for the past. He's convinced that many Zimbabweans are ready for a truth and reconciliation system.
The first sort of transitional justice conference in Zimbabwe was back in 2001. So civil society and so have been discussing and chewing on these issues for a long time. And I think that bodes well for putting together in the future a well-thought-through process that...
Pigou says it'll be complicated because the commission would likely not only focus on the actions of ZANU-PF, but also, for example, on those of the security forces during whites-only rule in the 1960s and 1970s. But he maintains none of this will be possible unless the culture of fear that permeates Zimbabwe is broken.
Will Mr. Mnangagwa's new government be party to reinforcing those feelings of fear? Or will the kind of spirit that we saw break out during the 10 days or so that led to Mr. Mugabe resigning, will that spirit that's been sort of popped out of the bottle, will they be able to force it back into the bottle? We simply do not know.
What we do know, says Pigou, is that the new government has wasted no time in following the path worn by the state under Mugabe. It already has arrested and charged several political opponents rather than trying to reconcile with them. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Zimbabwe political developments in the past week saw the exit of Robert Mugabe from his 37-year rule and the entry of Mugabe's longtime lieutenant, Emmerson Mnangagwa, as the new president. Eddie Cross has been in Zimbabwean politics for decades. He is a member of parliament for Bulawayo South under the ticket of the main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, and that is one of very few white Zimbabweans active in politics. He spoke with reporter Kudzai Zwinwanashe about Zimbabwe's political landscape.
You have been Mugabe's long-time critic. How do you feel that now he's out of the political landscape?
I have mixed feelings, to be frank. The big celebrations on the street on the Saturday and then the celebrations after he resigned felt that metaphorically we were dragging Mugabe through the streets. And I worked for Mugabe for 7 years after independence. You know, he's a brilliant man. And in the early days of independence, he made a great contribution to restructuring the country, giving black people here dignity, creating opportunities, and I think he deserved a better ending. But it's his own fault. He overstayed. Had he retired 20 years ago, he would have been a continental hero.
Okay, and what lessons can Zimbabweans and politicians learn from Mugabe's rule?
Well, first of all, don't overstay your time. Secondly, prepare for succession. Provide continuity. And I think Mugabe should have done that. And that should be the lesson of all African leaders. Don't overstay. Preparing succession, Smith failed, Mugabe failed. Will the next generation fail? I hope not. I hope that Mnangagwa recognizes he's a one-term president. If he wins the election in 2018, I hope he will retire in 2023. He's 75 years old, and he mustn't make the same mistake that Mugabe has made.
Speaking of Mnangagwa, what's your take on his new cabinet?
I think it's a disaster, and I think he knows that. And I think somewhere along the line, he was required to compromise with the military. And I think that what we now have is a military-controlled or certainly dominated government. You know, the problem with including old wine in new bottles is that the old wine contaminates the new. So you've got some new people, you've got some reasonably competent people, but I'm afraid that people like Obutum Pofu, really he should not have been allowed to continue.
Do you feel these few months that he has until we get to elections will be an opportunity for him to outshine his counterparts?
Look, I've said to all my colleagues in the opposition, don't underestimate this man. This man has been behind Mugabe for 37 years. But this is the genius in ZANU-PF. This is the man, the strategic thinker. This is the man who has controlled events in this country for the past 30 years. I think he's going to hit the ground running. The appointment of these special advisors is a fascinating development because what he's essentially done is formed an inner cabinet of people with technical competence. I respect July Moyo very much. And I think what he's going to do, he's going to try and turn the economy around. This is also a very tough guy. This is a ruthless man. This is a man who has killed in the past. And everybody knows that. You know, when he walks into Parliament, Parliament goes quiet. And I think that, quite frankly, we need a tough guy at the moment. We've got huge problems. We've got to deal with this corruption. We've got to stop corruption. If he doesn't stop corruption, there are no solutions.
Speaking on his toughness and his role that he played in the Mugabe era, do you think he will keep an open mind in regards to initiating electoral reforms and media freedom?
I don't think he's got any choice. I know that the Americans have told him, if you want recognition by the United States, if you want access to international market, money markets, if you want the IMF involved, you want the World Bank involved, and those are fundamentals, okay? If you want any of that, you have to deliver a free and fair election. And my understanding is that he's agreed to do that. And of course, part of a free and fair election is freedom of speech, freedom of association.
Maybe to touch on, you've been in government for a long time and you've obviously interacted with the president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, every now and then. What do you make of the man? What is he like?
He's unlike Mugabe. Mugabe has no friends. I cannot think of one real friend. If you know Mnangagwa, you know that he has many white friends, which really sets him apart. And he has many, many close friends. You know, July Moyo, Larry Mavima, Dan Mube. You know, I can enable them. These are good friends, friends who will fight in his corner. He's a man of principle. He's a bit of a cold fish, but he always jokes about issues in the House. He's a formidable intellect. If you take him on in the House of Assembly, expect to be slaughtered like a schoolboy in a debating society. But what else is he? Apparently today he's driven to work by himself. With his own car, three vehicles. He stops at robots, unlike Mugabe.
That was Eddie Cross, a member of the main opposition party, Movement for Democratic Change, and a member of parliament for Bulawayo South. He spoke with reporter Kudzai Zhuanashe from Zimbabwe's capital, Harare.
With President Mnangagwa's cabinet sworn in, everyone wants to know what's next. And on social media, many are asking if this truly is a new Zimbabwe. Here are some of the comments. D. Roberts says, when do the ministers start work? Can they start already? Need a lot of fixing. Enough talk. Tongai says, new cabinet sworn in, and now we want to see the plans and budgets. Tobias Sibanda says, Mnangagwa's home affairs and health minister Obed Mpofu and David Parerenyatwa will be sworn in today against popular sentiment. Clearly, Mnangagwa is not a listening president and might morph into another Mugabe or worse. Alice Chugumira says, Chinamasa is back. He was my grandmother's MP, my mom, me, my nephew, and now my great-nephew and niece. No hope at all. It's going to be worse than what we think. Ashley Jean says, "I don't understand what people truly expected of the new cabinet. Some old faces were bound to be there. Can we keep our optimism, focus on the results, and prepare to vote?"
21 health workers died in Zimbabwe when a truck they were traveling in crashed yesterday in Chalocho. 15 people died on the spot and 6 died after being taken to the Chalocho District Hospital. The driver reportedly failed to negotiate a curve and lost control of the Nissan UD truck. It overturned several times before landing on its roof along the highway. Health and Child Care Minister Mr. David Parinyato says the 28-year-old driver was reportedly drunk and had been warned 3 times to reduce speed before the horrific accident. Dr. Nyasha Masuka at the Chalocho Hospital says 48 passengers were injured, including the driver. The wounded have been taken to 3 different hospitals. Masuka says his hospital was able to handle all of the victims who came there and enough supplies. The truck belonged to the ministry, and the health workers were on their way to Matabeleland to work as anti-malaria teams. President Emmerson Mnangagwa has declared the accident a national disaster.
The UN is working with the government of Cameroon, Nigeria, and Chad to encourage communities to reintegrate rehabilitated ex-Boko Haram fighters and people held captive by the militian section. The inactive faces continued resistance. Moki Edwin Kenzaka reports from Kolofata, northern Cameroon.
200 women and children said to be ex-Boko Haram militants are in a makeshift camp here at Kolofata on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. The women say most of them were captured and kept in the Sambisa forest where they served as cooks and were subjected to rape and sexual slavery. They were eventually forced to join Boko Haram as fighters, spies and suicide bombers. Their sons were trained to fight, and daughters became suicide bombers. Among the ex-militants is Maimuni Aji, a 34-year-old mother of 3. She says they were saved from Boko Haram training camps after troops from Cameroon, Chad, and Nigeria, operating under a multinational joint task force, attacked Sambisa for 3 consecutive weeks in May 2017. She lost her remaining daughter in the attack. 2 others went as suicide bombers and have never returned. Aji says she returned home, hoping to find peace, but instead met violence from people who consider the returnees Boko Haram militants. She says her nightmare is not over. She says if she had not gone to buy food 2 weeks ago, she would have been killed in the fire that burned her house. She says she is left with nothing but a copy of her identity card that proves that she is a citizen of her village. Boko Haram forcibly recruited thousands of youths in Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger in its effort to create an Islamic State in West Africa. Muhammad Jamil, president of Nigerian Muslim Youths, says communities should accept the returning fighters and stop stigmatization, which may make them more radical. He says the military should also stop persecuting them as if they were still fighters.
The law enforcement agents are using excessive force on these people, such that even the innocent citizens have been killed alongside the militants, and that is giving the innocent citizen the thinking that the government is not for us, is against us, and now they lend more support to the extremists, give them cover. So we should reduce the force that we use in containing this. Dialogue, inclusive dialogue, is what will solve this, and not force.
Villagers say the ex-fighters and captives may be returning with Boko Haram ideology or be spies. Mohammed Chambers, the UN Special Representative in West Africa, says the worries of the population are legitimate. But Chambers says Cameroon, Nigeria, and Chad should promote de-radicalization centers to help reintegrate the former fighters and victims.
They have succeeded in pushing Boko Haram back. So on that security front, there has been good success, and we all commend the military efforts that have been taken. At the same time, let us address issues of governance, of bringing on board women and youth to tackle the root causes of violent extremism in Central Africa, in West Africa, in the Sahel.
Cameroon and the UN have been distributing seeds, goats, sheep and pigs to the returnees and asking their communities to welcome them. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Kolofata.
A new report says governments must do far more to include the needs of young people in the global fight against HIV and AIDS. Despite progress in tackling the disease, it is estimated that 1,700 new HIV infections occur every day amongst young people around the world, and the problem is particularly acute in Africa. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
It is time policymakers recognise that HIV-positive adolescents face unique challenges, says the report from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine alongside the charity Centre Bali. Among the recommendations are that young people receive adequate psychosocial support, a human rights-based approach to testing and care, and finding ways to sensitively discuss sex and relationships for adolescents living with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Professor Rashida Ferrand co-authored the research.
We really need to be thinking about all the barriers at every step in that broad environment, both at facility level and in clinics, etc., but also recognizing the fact that most of the time young people do not spend in facilities. So we have to think of modifying the environments and the barriers that those environments place.
Campaigners say many adolescents in Africa are unaware of their HIV status and are afraid to get tested. 23-year-old Masedi Kewamodimo was born with HIV. Both her parents died from AIDS. Growing up in her native Botswana, Masedi grew frustrated with the barriers she faced and decided to reveal her HIV status in order to campaign for better treatment. She spoke to VOA about that decision.
It's one of the most difficult thing I've ever faced in my whole life. Every single day I face stigma. People talk about it because one, they fear it. Two, they assume certain people within our society have it. Three, they feel that they cannot welcome people who are living with HIV and AIDS.
The charity Centre Bali, which helped put together the policy recommendations, was co-founded by Prince Harry, who is newly engaged to American actress Meghan Markle. She has also campaigned on health issues in Africa. Earlier this year, the Prince chaired a meeting in London on adolescents with HIV, titled Let Youth Lead, and called for a change in global education on the disease.
Young people, the first time they know or the first time they hear anything about HIV and AIDS is probably by the time it's too late. Whether it's in the education system here in the UK, whether it's across Africa, whether it's across the world, HIV needs to be treated exactly the same as any other disease.
Campaigners hope the royal couple's star power will help them spread the vital message that young people's needs and fears must be addressed in the global drive to tackle HIV and AIDS. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
That is it for us this evening on VOA Zimbabwe Today. I'm Chidonjere.
And I am Mike Hove. We'll be back again tomorrow at 9:30 p.m. Zimbabwe time for the latest news and analysis in English. VOA Shona and Ndebele broadcast can be heard at 6 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. Zimbabwe time.
Stay with us around the clock on Facebook at Studio 7, VOA Ndebele and VOA Shona, as well as our VOA website, www.studio7news.com.